As you probably know, this is the first of a paired lecture on what you might call Northern modernism, i.e. Scandinavian modernism, looking at hunger today, and Karen McAllister's Dangerous Age tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, nice and early, okay? So we'll start the discussion about what we mean by Northern modernism a little bit, although I don't want to specify the northern bit of it. One of the things we have been doing is, of course, investigating the various genealogies of modernism throughout this module. I want to start by considering these statements and all of them gesture towards a typical modernist trope, which is to say a breakthrough or a move forward. And I want to ask today, how is it that this early novel from a hitherto really less or less thoroughly mapped part of Europe, both culturally and geographically, i.e. Norway and Scandinavia, how is it that the breakthrough, what Georg Brandes calls the modern breakthrough in relationship Newt Hampson, how is it that the breakthrough into modernism occurs there, right? So that's the kind of term of today's lecture. So if you think back on the module overall, we've been looking at the kind of problematic, but nonetheless a succession of styles and modes, realism, naturalism, etc. Now, what we want to look at today is if realism, naturalism, etc. are taken to be kind of the central spine of the development of the novel form in Europe, why is it that the breakthrough to modernism happens on its northern fringes? And we'll revisit these questions later when we talk about, next week, when we talk about the leopard. Right. Okay, so let's go through those statements. Isaac Singer starts by saying the whole modern school of fiction in the 20th century stems from Hampson. Notice the word stems from. So modernism usually implies a breakthrough, right? A clean break from the past, and something new is beginning. Commonsensically, that's what we talk about when we talk about modernism. This is the sense in which Isaac Singer uses or describes Hampson's own work. There's something that's broken. And a new school, the school of modernism, he says, starts with Hampson. Similarly, Harold Bloom, again referring to Hampson's novel, says, when you read a canonical work for the first time, you encounter a stranger. And that really is the key to the commonsensical idea of modernism. You encounter a stranger. Suddenly, you're startled by this new encounter. An uncanny startlement rather than a fulfillment of expectations. And that really is the key to our normative ideas of modernism, the idea of startlement, encountering a stranger, and a denial rather than a fulfillment of expectations. That is what happens when you encounter a cultural work at the point of breakthrough. Both Singer and Bloom gesture towards this newness. After all, that in itself is the commonsensical understanding of what modern means, new, right? When we talk about the modern, we talk about that term, we apply to that term a sense of the contemporary and a sense of newness. So both Bloom and Singer attribute to Newt Hampson this sense of the moment of breakthrough when something new, something startling, and something strange appears in our cultural horizon. namely the modern novel. And that indeed is, if you look at it in terms of the literary history, or literary historiography of Europe or of Scandinavia, that is the sense in which this whole period of the 1880s to 1900, we've looked at other novels of this period before. Graham was talking about Pio Baroja operating roughly within this time scale, the last two decades of the 19th century and the first decade of the 20th century. That is designated as the Scandinavian critic Georg Brandes in 1883 terms, the modern breakthrough to convey the profound vistas and initiatives that we associate today with the names Ibsen, Strindberg, Jacobsen, Bjornsen, and to that list we should add Knut Hamsun. So that is just to set up the scene of how Hamsun and Hunger is received, both in terms within Scandinavia and Europe, but also in world historical terms. His novel is taken as the first instance that is beginning to really annoy me. The first instance of or one of the earliest, if not the first instance, of a cultural breakthrough. Something new is happening, the critics say. I'm going to turn this off and see if that solves this problem. Something new is happening. A new cultural frontier has been excavated. A strange encounter with a new cultural form is happening. So all those connotations of modernism is associated with Hamsun. Within this period in Norwegian, Danish, and Scandinavian literature and culture as such, that is called the period of the breakthrough. Again, if you think of the term the breakthrough, of course, it implies a temporal and spatial breakage or disassociation with the past, which is what the modern stands for. So our task today is to first question why and how that breakthrough happens in the northern fringes of Europe. The second question is, what is the nature of that breakthrough? Is it in fact a clean breakage from the cultural forms and the sensibilities of the past, or are there other things happening there? An ancillary question here is, of course, why, if a novel like Hunger is really about a breakthrough, why is the central feature of the novel one of denial? That is to say, self-denial, hunger, right? Starvation is our main topic in the novel, apparently, although I would suggest language alongside starvation are the two main themes of the novel. So one of the things we are asking is, if this is a novel about newness, if this is a novel about novelty, about the modern, why is it being articulated through a language of denial, of regression, of the body being wasted, of a mind that is unable to find a new language for itself? All these seem to be negative categories. Why is it that the whole idea of modernism is being articulated through a set of negative examples, a body wasting, a mind going mad, language breaking down, etc.? Of course, one of the things we notice immediately about this period as such, both in terms of Scandinavia and Europe, but also world literary and world historical developments, is that Hamsun is not alone in exploring the idea of modernism and modernity negatively. Famously, of course, his compatriot and contemporary Edvard Munch, this is a painting you'll be familiar with, The Scream. We'll come back to some of other Munch's works. And what I want you to notice, we've seen this, we'll look at the second companion piece by Munch as well, again being composed roughly around the same time as Hamsun. What you'll notice about the painting is not just the horror of this figure that The Scream tries to capture. What is this person? It's also a kind of interestingly transgendered body. I'm never quite sure whether that's a man or a woman, or it's meant to be. What is she or he screaming about? There's no obvious clue in the painting. There are two apparently unconcerned fellow human beings standing just a little bit behind the screaming figure, obviously over a body of water where boats, etc., are plying. There's no obvious clue as to what has so disturbed this particular figure. And that is, of course, the power of the work, that there is no obvious objective correlative to that particular expression of extreme horror, loneliness, isolation. But there are other kinds of clue, aren't there? Because what the painting does here is to put forward the proposition that at least part of what this figure is screaming about is the fact that the scream is silent and cannot be heard by her or his fellow human beings. Obviously, they don't appear to give a damn, actually, at that point. And we've seen these set pieces before. For example, think of Dostoevsky and the very familiar setting of the bridge on which Raskolnikov finds himself. We've talked about this before in various on various occasions. What overcomes Raskolnikov as he stands on the bridge and looks down at the body of water and that attempted suicide scene is precisely the feeling of being isolated in a crowd, right? This is what generates a kind of existential nausea in Raskolnikov. That something like that is happening in this painting. The thick daubs of color, the blood red sky up there, which are reflected on these bits of the bridge, the swirl of the body of the water and the human figures, all seem to speak of a kind of distorted perception, not only existing inside the painting, that is to say, the person is screaming because the world appears so distorted to her or him, but also for us, i.e., as viewers, we are looking at the world in an analogous way to what this person does. His or her scream, the implication is, are also echoing silently within us. Okay, so the power of the painting lies not only in the subject that's centered in the foreground, but also in how the painting presents itself, which is both a bid to communicate that sense of loneliness, isolation, hysteria, and a profound questioning of whether it's possible to communicate that whole structure of feeling at all. So the painting, in a way, through its composition, both suggests and denies the possibility of communicating the feeling that lies behind that silent scream. Many years later, in the 1960s, Marshall McLuhan, the media theorist, will coin an aphorism that will say, the medium is the message, right? There's nothing about the content. He's talking in terms of advertisement culture. Not coincidentally, of course, this novel, of course, starts with a scene of advertisement as well, and what the protagonist feels when he looks at these neon-lit superimposed words. But one of the things Monk does in his art is to put forward the suggestion that the very medium of communication, whether that's painting, whether that's language, whether that's novel, etc., in this period, 1880s to 1920s, let us say, the very medium of communication has become the central preoccupation of the artists and novelists and thinkers. The question that is being asked is, can we at all, is the possibility of communication at all valid, given what we now know of the medium of communication, i.e. language? Doesn't language deny itself through its own arbitrariness? That, we might say, is one of the things that the hunger artist in the novel, Knut Hamsun's novel, pushes himself to find out. Is it possible to derive meaning from language? If not, are we not all imprisoned in this echo chamber where our scream of horror is going round and round in our heads, but is not being heard by anyone outside. You'll see this, this is a very familiar theme for Monk in A Companion Piece to Anxiety. You have many more figures, but their relationship with the figure in the foreground is something like what was going on in the scream. There's a general, again, you see the blood-splattered clouds, the swirls of the landscape and the water behind it, and again, you have a raised bridge or a road on which the masses have gathered. None of them are able, their faces are blurred, their humanity is not immediately obvious to their companions. So one of the things Monk is doing there, again, both to the medium and the subject of the painting, is both raise the possibility of communicating this existential horror and denying it, or at least questioning it at the same time. So what we might say from all this as a signature feature of the kind of modernism that is taking hold in Scandinavia and indeed in most of Europe as such, is an artistic style that has turned in on itself insofar that the primary object of his investigation has now become its own medium, its own material body. So novels begin writing, novels start being written about the possibility of writing novels. Poetry starts being composed about the possibility of communicating linguistic meaning at all. Painting foregrounds its own unstable and contingent nature. What is happening is a continent-wide and an epoch-wide investigation into the possibility of communication at all. So in a way, previously, and this is we have seen these tendencies before, so we have seen Stendhal question the nature, or at least raise the nature of the novel in his own novel. We have seen many other metafictional passages embedded, Pio Baroja famously, about the possibility of writing at all. Here, of course, what has happened in this epoch is this fundamental questioning about the nature of language and the splintered or isolated nature of all individual human beings. The possibility of social cohesion, the possibility of communicating, is put under erasure. When such fundamental questions are being raised about language, one of the things we have to imagine or understand is they're never raised without their social implications. Such fundamental questionings about the possibility of communication automatically puts under pressure social codes, accepted social behaviors, social institutions like marriage. The other thing that happens in Scandinavian modernism of the time, this, of course, you'll recognize as quiz question one. Scene from For 2 points and a Packet of Crisps. Very good. 2 points and a Packet of Crisps. Don't forget to claim that. One of the things that happens in Scandinavian theater around this point, analogous to what is going on in Monk and Hamsun, etc., is not just the implication of what happens when you put the idea of language under pressure, but what are the social implications of that, right? A Doll's House and the final shattering exit of the central figure there with that famous slam door that scandalized audiences across Europe. We'll look at this in some more details when we do Michaelis tomorrow morning. Is that not just language, not just communication, but an entire social edifice built on those understandings. An entire social edifice, such as marriage, such as normative gender relationships, which rely on a shared understanding of what language is, how meaning is collectively produced, all those things are put under pressure at the same time. So Ibsen's theater as well as Strindberg's. We'll look at Strindberg's painting in a little bit. Both questions are put under pressure, the possibility of language, but also looks into what that pressurizing of our shared understanding means in terms of society. So marriage, patriarchy, understood relationship between the various classes, etc. All these things, all these moorings are unmoored once the very fundamental nature of our communication with each other, i.e. language, is questioned or denied. Golgotha, this is Strindberg's painting about, think about it. Golgotha obviously traditionally has redemptive connotations, the site of Christ's crucifixion, but also regeneration and redemption for humanity. Here it's complete. He paints Golgotha without the crosses, without the figure of Christ there at all. Rather, you have this semi-Gothic, spooky, swirly landscape where the very possibility of redemption is denied. Well, what we have to assess, of course, is that denial a part of modernism itself? Or is this some kind of new kind of questioning that's coming out that's essentially nihilistic in its propositions? In other words, going back to that question I started the lecture with, why is a novel that's taken as iconic, as an iconic example of modernism, something new, something startling, something strange, why is that novel concerned itself with self-denial figured in the body of its central character? What is the meaning of starvation? And that's the second part of your handout. Traditionally, Hampson's novel, I'll come back to, do any of you recognize the still from this film? Do you know which film this is? It is called Hunger, and it is by? Steve McQueen. You're not Googling it, are you? Okay. And there, McQueen puts the same proposition. I'll come back to why this scene is important. What is the meaning of hunger in Hunger, right? So the first part, we looked at Hampson's novel as being a breakthrough novel that paradoxically denies or puts the idea of negation at its heart. The second part in the lecture today is talking about the various meanings of what hunger is. Now, one way of reading Hunger in the novel, and this has been a kind of old traditional way of reading what the novel is about, is to read it biographically. This is on your handout, Inge Sletten Colluan's biography of Knut Hamsun, Dreamer and Dissident, starts. Hamsun was clearly pushing himself to his limits. Between lectures in the US, his friends often found him cold, hungry, confused, and in a state of exhaustion. Yet he would still triumphantly present them with the newly minted pages for the novel that he still insisted would change everything. It was 17 July 1888, the height of summer in Copenhagen. Hamsun pawned his raincoat for six kroner, rented a room for 5 kroner a month in the workers' quarter of Norebro, and began making plans for launching his literary career. He felt his time was running out. 3 weeks after reaching Copenhagen, it would be his 29th birthday. And this has been a kind of traditional way of reading what the novel is about. Hamsun himself is here, the archetypal struggling artist, deprived, etc., writing his masterpiece, about to make the breakthrough. One of the things that this line of inquiry doesn't answer is, why does Hamsun, if the novel is autobiographical, why does Hamsun make his hero, the hunger artist, a kind of peculiarly willful creature who denies food? Hamsun, historically, of course, is poor, impoverished, moving. There's no question of denial there. What is the meaning of that gesture that denies sustenance when you want it? That's the paradox around which Hamsun creates his novel. Why does the hunger artist deny all succor, or at least accept it very sporadically and then immediately rejects it? So the biographical explanation of the novel's charge takes us only so far. The other approach to the novel has been to look at the cultural and sociological meaning of hunger. And here, Maud Elman's work about the hunger artists of the IRA, the Irish Republican decades of the 1970s and 80s, comes in handy. And this is also on your handout. For Elman, so Elman asks the same question. What is the meaning of self-starvation? We know what famine means. We know what happens when people or whole communities or societies starve, not out of their own volition. There's a clear set of meanings there of oppression, poverty, etc. But why does what happens when one person or a singular being refuses succor? What does that mean? Self-starvation, says Maud Elman, is above all a performance. And this is interesting when you look at what this, what the hunger artist is actually doing in the book. Right? Why does he refuse food? Part of it is a performance, says Elman. Like Hamlet's mousetrap, it is staged to trick the conscience of its viewers, forcing them to recognize that they are implicated in the spectacle they behold. This is at the root of why we feel uneasy when we look at the hunger artist repeatedly denying his body any sustenance, any nourishment, or at those moments when he chews a rotting bone or gulps down milk and immediately throws it up. Why that makes us queasy, right? That makes us uncomfortable. So there's a direct proposition between the spectacle of self-starvation and our unease. What is the nature of this unease? Even though the anoretic body seems to represent a radical negation of the other, i.e. it's destroying itself, it doesn't give a hoot about what other people think about that process, it still depends upon the other as a spectator in order to be read as representative of anything at all. Thus, its emaciation, which seems to indicate a violent rebuff, I don't care what you think of what I do, also bespeaks a strange adventure in seduction. That's a kind of interesting thought. How can self-starvation be, Maud Elman's words, a strange spectacle of seduction? How are we being seduced? And why? Now, for those of you who know your Kafka, of course, you'll recognize that Kafka picks up exactly this figure, the hunger artist, in a short story called The Hunger Artist, which is written a couple of decades after Hamsun. And Kafka deliberately picks up or distills. It's a very Kafkaesque short story. It's very bare. It's very it's reduced to its sort of basic elements. But the story is of an artist who works in some kind of circus, and his act is to starve himself in a cage in front of his audience. And the story is what the story tells us is what he feels when he's being looked at. A bit like what we feel when we look at that figure in the film, who is analogous to the IRA hunger artist of the 1970s, Bobby Sands, etc. And this is what Kafka writes about the relationship between spectacle and starvation. What Elman is suggesting here is starvation only accrues meaning through the gaze of the other. Although starvation, we've looked at suicides before. Various of our novels, various heroes and heroines of our novels have killed themselves before. And we have discussed, certainly in some of my seminars, about what is the meaning of the act of suicide. Right? Here, this is not so much an act of suicide, but an act of self-negation that at the same time says, I'm refusing all contact with you, the spectators. On the other hand, the meaning of the spectacle doesn't really arrive at us unless someone is looking at that body being wasted, which is why people in the book react so violently to the hunger artists, the spectacle of hunger artist starving himself. Kafka, as I say, picks up on this relationship between looking and starving, looking and denying. Nothing was more excruciating to the hunger artist than such watchers. This is from Kafka. They depressed him. They made his fasting terribly difficult. Sometimes he overcame his weakness and sang during the time they were observing, for as long as he could keep it up to show people how unjust their suspicions about him were, but that was little help. For when they just wondered among themselves about his skill at being able to eat even while singing, he much preferred the observers who sat down right against the bars and, not satisfied with the dim backlighting of the room, illuminated him with electric flashlights, which the impresario made available to them. The fundamental question that is being asked by Kafka here is, what is the relationship between spectatorship and suffering, spectatorship and self-denial? And that is a question he picks up from Hamsun, from Hunger, where in the novel, we as readers are being asked to assess what is it that disturbs us about this person's willful refusal of food. So alongside the biographical explanation, what this line of inquiry offers us is a wider investigation of the nature of starvation and the art of hunger. Remember, there's a distinction being made here between self-willed starvation and mass starvation, as in a catastrophic event like famine, etc. Why does this starving figure become such a prominent one in modernism? A third line of inquiry is the one that grows in response to this literature and this spectacle. In the early decades of the 20th century, what the school of thought we now know as Soviet formalism or formalist criticism, V.N. Voloshinov, the degree to which an experience is perceptible, distinct, and formulated is directly proportional to the degree to which it's socially oriented, says Voloshinov. So Dana Pollan explains this statement by saying there is no such thing, Voloshinov suggests, as the real existence of hunger as category. Rather, there are only particular hungers. So this is a familiar explanation to us. The power of the novel, of this novel, for example, or Kafka's story, is directly proportional to the society within which these novels are being read and the meaning of social hunger there. So there are three kind of lines of explanation. One, biographical. One, if you like, existential / philosophical, about what a particular act of hunger and spectatorship means to us. And the third, sociological. Hunger as a category only makes sense to an extent that our own collective memories and that of the writers, etc., participate in a social memory of deprivation and hunger. So there are kind of three lines of inquiry. One of the things we'll have to decide is, where does Hamsun's novel sit between these lines? So starting with the idea that hunger is a form of social language, form of social communication. And McQueen's film is interesting because he picks up, of course, those of you who've seen the film will know, these quotes are on your handout, I've just read them out. As you know, hunger can be a socially powerful medium. These are Irish prisoners at Long Kesh in the 1970s who went famously on a hunger strike. The most prominent amongst them, Bobby Sands, died of the hunger strike, leading to scenes such as this, both in the Republic and Northern Ireland. This is the funeral of Bobby Sands. So clearly, hunger there, you can see by the presence of the people there, that hunger as a spectacle can definitely have a wide social impact. These hunger artists have killed and starved themselves for a stated political cause, and that meaning has been communicated to the masses. But Ellman, and this is the third and final section of your handout, Ellman points out something interesting there between that event between their self-willed starvation and that scene. So this is Ellman talking about hunger as language. The whole quotation is not there, so I'm going to read out a little bit, and then that's the finish of the final part of the passage. The hunger strikers of Lonkesh, the men whose photographs that we've just seen, claimed that they were fasting to resist the prison uniform. That was the immediate trigger of the hunger strike. What had happened was they refused to wear the prison uniform because the prison uniform would designate them as common criminals. They were demanding the status of political prisoners. Political prisoners have a different set of rights to food, to reading, to clothes, etc., than common criminals, and they were demanding that they be upgraded to that status, if you can call that upgrading, because they were fighting a political cause. So that was the immediate cause of the hunger strikes. So what Ellman picks up here is the gap between what they're saying and what they're doing, i.e., the demand was one of better conditions in prison. The action is of a radical self-negation, is a prolonged, painful death. So this is what Ellman says. The hunger strikers of Lonkesh claimed that they were fasting to resist the prison uniform. But it's scarcely plausible that anyone would starve to death in order to wear civilian clothes. The gap between the rhetoric and the catastrophe is staggering. Nonetheless, their arguments increased and multiplied as furiously as their bodies decomposed, as if their flesh was being eaten by their words. The more they spoke, the shriller the rhetoric got. Obviously, their body got more and more emaciated because they were fasting. So she picks up in this relationship between an excess of rhetoric, an excess of language, and the decay of the body. The thinner the body gets, the more voluble the language gets. While it is easy to interpret this relationship in terms of an economy of sacrifice, whereby the immolation of the body is rewarded by the gift of words, this precisely is, of course, what the hunger artist thinks is going on in the novel. He says, the more I starve, the more I write, but is the writing any good? That's the problem that he's faced with. And this is the paragraph that you do have. For writing voids the mind of words just as starving voids the body of its flesh. And both expresses the yearning for an unimaginable destitution. We do not starve to write, which is what the hunger artist seems to think in the novel, but we write to starve. And we starve in order to affirm the supremacy of lack and to extend the ravenous dominion of night. Going back, expressing a sentiment that's very, very similar to that figure. We starve, we write to starve in order to affirm the supremacy of lack. That's, if you think of modernism essentially as something that moves forward, that progresses, that ushers in the new, etc., that's an interesting proposition because what it's saying is, if you think of words, the relationship between words and your brain and your consciousness and food and your body, what Ellman is saying is, what we do when we write is to void our minds. We leech out our thoughts into the form of writing. That is analogous to what we do when we starve. We deny our body food and we emaciate it. What we do in both cases is to affirm the gaping hole that exists at the core of human consciousness and existence. Okay? And this is, of course, the hole that gets figured in the novel, in the hunger artist's imagination of God having dipped the finger, his divine finger, into his nervous system and dragged it out with the ends of his filaments hanging up. And this figure of the hole at the core of human existence echoes through any number of novels and plays and theater of this time. You could argue the entire Beckettian oeuvre is constructed around this figure of lack that is at the heart of human existence. You could also think of that moment in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness where Marlowe says, I could just poke my finger into the papier-mâché Mephistopheles, the manager of the rubber plantation he meets in the middle of Congo, and he imagines that all he has is a little bit of dust within him. He can poke the finger through it, which is then picked up by Eliot in his epic of the modern times, Wasteland. So the idea that at the core of human existence lies a lack, lies a gap, lies for Ellman at the heart of the mystery of self-starvation. What do you do when you deny your body food? What do you do when you write? You're gesturing, you're coming ever close to the blankness, the nothingness around which your sense of being, of yourself, is constructed. That is one of the wages of modernism. It's a peculiar paradox, a mode and a style that gestures towards the new. But what new proposition is being imagined here is that, in fact, there is no escape from the central lack that constructs you. And one of the things that the novel picks up on is precisely what this existential lack means to perhaps the fundamental feature of human beings. Quite often, when you look at evolutionary biology, you'll see the human species being categorized as linguistic animals, right? What distinguishes, above all, human species from other species is said to be the capacity for language. Now, does the question that Hampson and others are asking here is this: that if at the core of the human existence lies a lack that you can never quite embody in your art, but you must try and do so because that's the primary order duty of the artist, how does that lack manifest itself in language? And the whole novel, Hampson's novel, is structured around this paradox of communicating the incommunicable. How do you write silence? How do you write lack? One of the things that the hunger artist finds out, of course, is language, being far from a natural attribute, is an entirely arbitrary one. So when he says to the policeman, hang on, it's not 2 o'clock, it's 10 o'clock. The policeman says, it's 10 o'clock. He says, no, it's 2 o'clock. What he's gesturing towards is not so much a breakdown in his signifying capacities, but actually a breakthrough whereby he discovers that language is arbitrary. So when he names someone Lajali, or when he calls, when he invents a new word, Kabuam, what's he doing? He's making this modernist breakthrough into the realization that there is no natural givenness to language. At the heart of it, what language is arbitrary. There is no natural grammar, there is no natural set of meaning that lies outside language that you can gesture towards. So throughout the novel, what he does is he tests out the implication of this. If there is no arbitrary meaning to language, then you are free to invent what you can, whenever you can. Kabuam, Lajali, etc. So Hampson, and this is what Weinstein picks up in the final section of your handout, Hampson has realized that ordinary signification and communication are governed by constraints and rules of all stripes. Let us call it grammar, for example. Intentionality, social setting, established convictions. Hampson knows that the world he inhabits is scripted already, that we are agents in a setting we never made, a setting called culture. You might begin your war, your version of 1848. We'll come back to the signification of 1848 in a second. By creating a fully ludic character, not so much a trickster as an unbound figure, a figure unconstrained by logic and propriety. He knows full well that body and society are enslaved by laws at once physiological, social, cultural. He also knows that language itself hardly seems all that free, or as Nietzsche said, as long as there is grammar, we will not be free. Knowing all these things, Hampson wages his counteroffensive. He will say no to food and money and bounded identity and rational behavior. He will even say no to dictionary. From grammar to food to money, the hunger artist rejects all these elements that, after all, offer us rules for how to live in society. What he's exploring is the essential nature of freedom. What does it mean to be free? Is freedom a negation of all rules? In which case, of course, you're being pushed to this absurd existence that he leads. Or is freedom always qualified by a compromise between your individual existence and this set of rules that govern society around you? That's the question that's being proposed here, which is why, as Paul Auster says, something new has been proposed here. The artist doesn't want to succeed, he wants to fail. He wants to find out what failure means and what meaning failure confers onto human existence. 1848, the date that he scribbles compulsively everywhere, of course, is the date of the tremendous continent-wise but ultimately doomed set of revolutions that gripped Europe, whereby a new set of propositions about new human possibilities were raised and then denied. What the hunger artist is doing when he's obsessively writing 1848 is both admitting the failure of collective action of redemption, so we think of Strindberg's Golgotha there, no possibilities of Christ on the cross, but also a kind of privatization and individualization of that rebellious gesture. What he's doing here is in effect, distilling the spirit of 1848 into this anarchic, revolving self that is the hunger artist. He's denying the rules of grammar, trying to deny the rules of grammar. He's trying to deny the rules of the body. He's trying to deny the rules of economics, hence his cavalier attitude to money. And the novel frequently gives it away, if you remember, and then complains. So what we have here, coming back to that question we started with, what does this figure mean to us? Is it a figure of negation? Or is it a figure that helps us investigate the rules, the boundaries, the compromises that our lives are structured by? And that maybe is the new that that is usually attributed to modernism, but also to Scandinavian modernism at the turn of the century. Tomorrow, we'll look at some of these issues by looking at another kind of body, also in extremis, also under duress, but this time it is not starvation, but it is the woman's body's denial of its reproductive agency, i.e. a body in menopause that we'll look at tomorrow morning, again looking at the questions of language, denial, etc. So with that cheerful thought, should go back into sunshine.